In April of 2018, West Bromwich Albion were simply trying to reach the end of the Premier League season. One more month, and the pain would be over. By every definition, the season had been dismal for the Baggies. With just 6 games to play in the season, the team had all but 3 wins, and had lost 8 of their last 10. If not for the parity at the bottom of the league that season, they would have been virtual locks to be relegated. At the start of the month, Darren Moore, a former player, took the reins as head coach after Alan Pardew and the club parted ways. Pardew himself had been an interim manager following the firing of Tony Spoulis at the start of the season. Suffice to say, it was a rough time to be a West Bromwich Albion fan. But on this particular day, maybe not so much. West Brom were embroiled in a tense and grueling match with the league's second place team, Manchester United. Second place in the league table was nothing to scoff at, but United had drawn criticism all year long for their low scoring and sluggish approach to football. Jose Mourinho, their Portuguese manager, was well known for his defensive antics, as he often favored to park his players in front of goal in lieu of fancy, eye-catching football, despite having the quality players to play that kind of football. And they found themselves in one of those sluggish affairs today. As it often did in Manchester, rain was pouring down in sheets. The Reds looked incoherent through much of the first half, but the Baggies had also lucked out. Referee Paul Tierney was just a bit too far from the play, and he waved off a would-be penalty from West Brom defender Craig Dawson in just the 16th minute of the game. Sensing a lack of fight from their hosts, West Brom played adventurously, probing the United defense throughout the match where so often they would have sat back, fearful of giving up a goal. United's goalkeeper, David De Gea, made a phenomenal one-hand save in the 11th minute to keep out Jake Livermore's attempt. On the other side of the field, Ben Foster, the ex-United man himself, had delivered some decent saves to keep the game scoreless through the first 45 minutes. And it had been a slow first half. At no point did the Premier League Giants push the worst team in the league into a corner and take charge. The door had been left wide open for the Baggies. But come halftime, Mourinho sought to wake up his sleepwalking men in red. Through the first 20 minutes of the second half, the United manager brought on Anthony Martial and Jesse Lingard to provide a spark to the team's offense. But Ben Foster was miraculous between the pipes, denying a Romelu Lukaku header with the tip of his fingers, diving across the face of goal. Jesse Lingard put a well-taken shot just wide of goal only a few moments later, and for a brief while, Manchester looked poised to end the Baggies' hopes of an upset. But in the 73rd minute, West Brom earned a corner. Chris Brunt raised his hand to the sky and delivered the ball to the back post. The Manchester defense was scattered and unset for the corner, but Nemanja Matic rose to meet the ball. He headed the ball right in front of his own net, where Jay Rodriguez of West Brom was racing in, completely unmarked. Rodriguez met the ball with his own head, sending a splash of water off his rain-soaked head, and the ball plowed down into the turf, bounced back up, and into the back of the net, with De Gea planted like a tree. Old Trafford, a palace of English football that has seen Manchester United bring home 13 Premier League titles, was silent. A few West Brom faithful were in an uproar, obviously, but by the time the final whistle blew on that 1-0 defeat for United, thousands of United fans had already left the stadium. The Baggies fans on the away side of the field were chanting, "Manchester, we want it for you." Not Manchester United, no. Because with that 1-0 victory, West Bromwich Albion, the league's last place team, had just sealed the Premier League title for the Reds' cross-town rival, Manchester City. With 5 games to play and 16 points on their second place foes, City had won the league on a day when they weren't even playing. No playoffs, no championships, no problems. Manchester City's manager, Pep Guardiola, was miles away, playing golf, and had just captured the team's 3rd league title in club history. And right now it's December, which means that NFL fans in the United States are calculating every possible way in which their team can make the playoffs. Fans of the New York Jets, on the other hand, are calculating every possible way their team can get the first overall pick in the draft. Traditional sports fans are used to one league and one league only. If their team is good, they have hopes and excitements of playoffs, where virtually every team has the same opportunity to win a title. And if their team is poor, they can rest easy, knowing that they're going to get another crack at it next year and likely have a high draft pick to make their team even better for next year. But such is not the case with soccer. In most leagues around the world, promotion and relegation is par for the course. None of Europe's big five leagues have playoffs to finish a season. A champion is declared when they've accumulated the most points. And there are no drafts either. Teams at the bottom of the pack fight for the opportunity to stay in the league, because if they're one of the bottom three or four teams, they're relegated to a lower division, which means loss of television rights, which means loss in revenue. And nobody wants that. Just a month after West Bromwich Albion guaranteed a title for Manchester City, their own fate was sealed by a game they weren't playing in, and they were relegated to the second division of English football, the Championship. Promotion and relegation, or pro-rel, is one of the foundations of European soccer, but it's also a confusing aspect for fans who are used to sports, including soccer, in the United States where no such system exists. This week, we touch on the basics, the playoff situation, and get an understanding of the contentious debate for pro-rel in Major League Soccer on win, lose, or draw. May 26th, 2018, Wembley Stadium. Fulham are playing Aston Villa in the English Championship playoff finals. A lot of words that typically mean the same thing, but not in this case. While promotion and relegation may be foreign to us in the United States, playoffs are not entirely foreign to European football. Outside of the Premier League, the final promotion spot for each division in the English soccer pyramid includes playoffs, and this is fairly common throughout the European leagues. For the Championship, the second division, the top two teams in the league are automatically promoted to the Premiership. The final promotion spot is determined via a tournament between the 3rd through 6th place teams. The two semi-final games are played home and away, and the final is played at Wembley Stadium to often sell-out crowds. And such is the case here today. Over 80,000, predominantly local Fulham fans, are packed into the stands to watch the final. Tensions are as high as the temperature, and rightfully so. The financial benefit of the promotion to the Premier League is worth over $180 million in broadcast rights, which could escalate an extra $40 million if the promoted team manages to stay in the top flight beyond the next season. With that kind of cash value, the Championship final is one of the most lucrative games in association football. Fulham had been drummed out of the playoffs the previous year, and at the midway point of this season had seemed set to miss them altogether. But then, the London-based club rattled off a 23-game unbeaten run to claw their way back into playoff contention. Had it not been for a loss on the final day of the season, they would have clinched automatic promotion. But they were forced to settle for a stake in the playoffs. And right now, it's the 23rd minute. Ryan Sessegnon, Fulham's teenage boy wonder, takes a heavy touch on a strong pass from teammate Kevin McDonald near the top of the box. But still, he races down his mistake and keeps possession away from Villa's Conor Horion. With a deft flick of the ball, Sessegnon makes the entire crowd wonder how he could possibly be under the age of 20 as he threads a perfect pass between Villa defenders John Terry and Alan Hood. His captain, Tom Kearney, races onto the ball and is in perfect position to strike.
Lovely ball, chance, goal. It's the captain, Tom Kearney, and Fulham lead in the race for that Premier League place.
The Nottingham native had just put his side up 1-0 in a game worth a small fortune. Fulham's teenage star in the making had provided the assist. The crowd was on their side, and Villa, seemingly stunned, could bring nothing together to challenge the London-based side for the first 45 minutes. Hang on to this lead, and a spot in the Premier League awaited Fulham after four seasons in the Championship. If only it were as easy as I just made it sound. In the second half, Aston Villa came out firing, behind the leadership of their own young star, Jack Grealish. The 22-year-old Englishman dribbled through not one, not two, not even three, but four defenders in a marvelous solo effort. With a subtle step over, he sprung free from the last Fulham defender on his side and shot from just 7 yards out. but a Fulham defender managed to deflect the ball right to the keeper, saving the advantage for just a moment. Sessegnon responded in turn. In the 65th minute, he dribbled from the sideline to the center of the pitch toward goal. With a quick step over, he froze the Villa defender in place and passed to his right, where Stefan Johansson was free in front of goal, but his shot sailed just over the bar. Minutes later, though, on 70 minutes played, Grealish took a heavy touch and raced up to meet his misplayed ball. Fulham defender Dennis Odoi stepped for the ball as well, and the opponents collided as Odoi raised his leg to make a play on it. Grealish crumpled onto the pitch, and the whistle blew. Yellow card. Odoi was beside himself. Worst of all, it was his second yellow, and the requisite red card promptly followed. Odoi was sent off, and Fulham would have to play the final 20 minutes a man down. But the Cottagers never wavered. Despite sending wave after wave of attacking players against them, Fulham stood strong. Aston Villa played like mad animals, never bringing any semblance of composure in the final 20 minutes, satisfied with letting Grealish attempt to carry the team to victory. And at the last gasp of injury time, Aston Villa sent one more desperate long ball into the box. It met the head of a Fulham defender, and then another until finally meeting the foot of Captain Tom Kearney, who booted it high into the air.
Referee looks at his watch. It is a fabulous day for Fulham. Fashionable, friendly Fulham back amongst the giants of the Premier League.
It was utter mayhem. Players and coaches alike sprinted onto the field. The overwhelming number of Fulham fans threw smoke canisters onto the field, bathing the pitch in white and black smoke. Goalkeeper Martis Bettinelli picked one up and triumphantly ran in front of the screaming fans, pumping his fist in the air. After four seasons, Fulham had cemented a place back among the English football giants and guaranteed themselves millions of dollars to invest in the club's current players and even buy new ones. Alternatively, the newly relegated West Bromwich Albion were preparing to begin play without the Premier League's guaranteed broadcast fees. For the average team, just playing in the Premier League is enough to net over $100 million. Additionally, you would think that playing in the top division of English football would make it easier to return the following year after getting relegated, but that's not so. It takes an average of just over 3 years for relegated clubs to return to the top flight, and that's if they return at all. If it takes longer than 3 years, they're just as likely to never return as they are to complete the Herculean effort. But why 3 years? Well, because of parachute payments. Like a disgraced executive of a former Fortune 500 company, relegated teams are given a percentage of the funds that they would have had if they were a member of the Premier League for their first few years after relegation. For West Bromwich Albion this season, that 55% equates to roughly $55 million. Not bad. And a nice chunk of change to build up the squad for the fight back up the ladder. That is, if the club's finances were in order, which, given the lofty costs of running a team, is a rarity in association football. Worse still, that percentage goes down with each passing year out of the top flight. By year four, it's hardly anything, making investing in the team on the pitch increasingly difficult. With that in mind, it's easy to understand that only one of the four teams in the championship playoffs, Fulham, was even receiving parachute payments at the time. They're not exactly a guarantee of success. And while relegated teams still get paid to some extent, promotion and relegation works because it rewards the good teams and penalizes the bad teams. One need look no further than the Philadelphia 76ers for the difference here. While American sports teams can game the system and tank to leverage draft picks in their favor and then continue to build their team, promotion and relegation ensures that teams stay competitive throughout the season. At the bottom of the table, late in the year, every game matters, even as late as the final game, and fans wait on the edge of their seats to see if their club will survive the dreaded relegation battle. But is the championship really as bad as relegation gets? In 1987, Luton Town, a small football club located in Bedfordshire, England, finished 7th in English First Division, the equivalent of the modern Premier League. A year later, in 1988, they vanquished Arsenal, the London Giants, to win the League Cup. And while they're known for their tumultuous history, Luton Town appeared poised to stick around. But after 10 years in the top flight, the Hatters were relegated once again to the second division. And they fought admirably in cup competitions despite their second-tier status, but they only just managed to fight off relegation before succumbing to the fall again the following season, the third division. And remember what I said about financial stability being a rarity in English football? Well, administration loomed for the struggling Luton Town several times throughout the early 2000s. They were racked with debt and struggling to generate revenue. The team changed ownership several times, and players were sold to make up funds, and the Hatters were even frequently docked points for falling into financial disarray, which sent them tumbling down the league table and into the fourth division, and finally, non-league. Non-league, also known as rock bottom. The English Football Association recognizes four divisions of league football: the Premier League, then the Championship, then League One, and then League Two. When you fall out of the fourth division, you become non-league. And this is a common trend throughout many other European leagues. A non-league team has never reached the top flight of English football, and they're made up of hundreds of teams, semi-professional and professional, and the leagues are only loosely organized. While it's not a death sentence, it's hardly a good thing. But with new owners, Luton Town resolved their financial issues, and after 6 years in the non-league, they invested enough to bring their side back into the land of recognized football, and today play at League One. Generally speaking, non-league teams don't have the ownership willing to invest the capital needed to gain promotion to the English Football League, and the ones who do tend to have previously played there. So, yeah, there are worse things than being relegated from the Premier League to the Championship. And in addition to Luton Town, only four other teams have ever tumbled from the very top to the very bottom. While it's unlikely and perhaps the most devastating of outcomes of promotion and relegation, former Giants have suffered similar fates. Nottingham Forest, one of the most prestigious clubs in England and winners of the top division, four League Cups, two FA Cups, and even the Champions League, fell as low as the third division in the early 2000s after their own rampant financial crisis. And they haven't returned to the Premier League since being relegated in 1999. Mention ProRel to a crowd of American soccer fans, and you're pretty likely to start an argument so heated that you'll be lucky if the building you're in is still standing by the end of it. Major League Soccer, along with every other American sports league, has no semblance of promotion and relegation, and it's one of the first things an MLS detractor will cite as their cause for disdain. But why? Because while European and countless other teams around the world are rewarded with cash for reaching the top flight, American teams are expected to pony up just to join it. That's not to say there isn't a soccer pyramid in the United States, though. The second division, just below Major League Soccer, is the United Soccer League. The National Premier Soccer League, a semi-professional league, plays in the fourth division. And at the moment, there is no third division, as the previous league, the North American Soccer League, ceased operations in 2017, after their Division II status was revoked by the United States Soccer Federation as it failed to field 10 teams due to their own financial concerns. And therein lies the contention with ProRel in the United States. Given Major League Soccer's single-entity structure, teams have to buy in to participate. There is absolutely no promise of financial reward for lower division clubs that field strong teams because their only way in is to pay to play. Most ProRel supporters would argue that without it, lower division teams will be challenged to maintain long-term success because MLS dominates the television and ticket market. And they're right. The sport is boxed in by the success of its top league, rather than multiple leagues growing together. Now, the USL has maintained financial viability by partnering with MLS in player development deals that allow MLS teams to field reserve squads in return for financial support from the league. Some USL or NASL clubs have bought their way into MLS, but that requires lucrative ownership groups, whereas clubs around the world can play their way in with smart and effective team building. But ProRel detractors would tell you that their league was designed in the only way that it would work, We learned last week that the single entity structure ensured MLS success in the United States by spreading wealth throughout the league. To change now would be to completely overhaul the league structure that has sustained it as one of the most successful soccer leagues in the country's history. Without getting too much into my own position, there is absolutely a case for ProRel in the United States. Whether or not it will happen is a completely separate issue, and one that will certainly be discussed as grassroots soccer efforts pop up all over the United States. This episode was researched, written, and produced by me, Chris Singelman. And this is definitely not the last time we'll be discussing promotion and relegation on this show, so let us know your take. Join the conversation. You can find us at the WLOD Show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. As always, you can reach us privately via email at the WLODshow@gmail.com. Subscribe and follow so you never miss a moment of win, lose, or draw. If you like what you're hearing, give us a rating. More reviews help us share this content with other podcast listeners just like you. See you next time on Win, Lose, or Draw.